joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Walt Disney once said, when people laugh at Mickey Mouse, it's because he's so human. And that's the secret of his popularity. Anthropologist Barbara King believes being with animals reminds us that we were once wild and indeed are still animals. In a new book, she explains our fascination with other creatures and how our connection with them has evolved over thousands of years. Her new book is titled Being with Animals, Why We Are So Obsessed with the Furry, Scaly, Feathered Creatures Who Populate Our World. Barbara King joins me in the studio. She's a biological anthropologist and professor at the College of William and Mary. She is the owner of six cats and a rabbit named Oreo. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Barbara. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I know that having just said you have six cats and a rabbit, those aren't the only animals you've been studying a lot. You've got a lot of experience studying apes. Tell us about the connections you've made with them.
Yes, I've been lucky enough to study apes in a number of zoological parks, including here in Washington, D.C. I also have studied bonobos, a type of ape similar to chimpanzees. And the connections that I make are very immediate and very moving. In the old days, we used to be very objective and walk in and whip out a computer and take data. But now we greet the animals. We try to enter into their world, try to make them understand that we're there and wish to make a connection with them. So, for example, I'll walk up to gorillas and try to pleasure rumble with them, their greeting, their vocalization.
Like what?
Oh, it's a deep rumble in the chest. They're very forgiving of my accent, my human accent, and they will grumble and rumble back to me. This is a way of my saying, I'm entering your world. I'd like to sit with you. I'd like to watch you. And from there, I then take the data. But it is an important realization that they're sentient, conscious beings who are watching my every move and coming to spend part of my day with them.
So where does that lead you?
It leads me to think of these apes as creatures with fellow feeling, with emotion, that they're not only conscious, but that, and they have family bonds with each other, but that they're able, with apes particularly now, to have a type of intersubjectivity, to be able to think about how I might see the world and to know that the way that I might see the world is not the same as the way they might see the world. To give you an example, we now know that if an ape dies, many zoos will allow the family members to view the body and to sit and grieve at the body. And what is most striking to me is that some apes seem to acknowledge the closest relative or the closest friend of the deceased and basically give them priority of time to sit with the body, acknowledge that emotional connection. So what's so fascinating about that is not only to say that these animals have grief, but that there's a recognition by one animal of another's very particular and special bond. So that's a cognitive process as well as an emotional one that goes much deeper than we used to think.
And I gather you're not just talking about the apes or the gorillas or the chimpanzees. You're also talking about elephants.
That's right. I began to research more widely for this project a number of other species. My own research experience is limited to primates. When I started to read about elephants, I was really astonished. I did spend some time in Amboseli National Park in Kenya for my doctoral research on baboons, and I was able to informally watch some elephants. a researcher there told me that, again, there is an amazing recognition of death, that elephants will caress the bones of loved ones even while they walk by the bones of strangers. Even if they've been away from the region where the bones are located for several weeks, this is something we don't understand. The empathy that elephants feel for each other is very evolved. So part of my writing about the human-animal relationship is to have us understand that the emotion that we feel is very much reflected in our fellow creatures, that we share a kind of journey through the world where it's not just that we're all living in the present and going out to get food, but rather that we have emotional responses that we share, very importantly.
And you actually begin the book with a very moving image, the procession of animals on St. Francis mm-hmm. Day. Mm-hmm. Would you read that for us?
Yes. This is a day in October when my family and I went to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Manhattan, and the book starts in this way. Everyone could feel it. Anticipation weighted the air as the St. Francis Day church service unfolded at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. Finally, the massive front door swung open into the largest of all cathedrals in North America, flooded in early autumn light, a light that illuminated the creature that walked first through the door, a camel, head held high, its single hump garlanded with flowers. Anticipation turned to reverence, and 1,200 people turned their gaze as one. Behind the camel and its white-robed caretaker came a royal yak, a tundra reindeer, a baby wallaby, and a baby ape, plus a black sheep named Marvin. A giant tortoise named Oscar rode on two pillows arranged on a wagon. Birds of prey and a host of smaller creatures, from bunnies to hermit crabs, were carried or pulled on carts. Slowly, with calm and dignity, the procession of animals made its way to the front of the church. There, the animals were blessed by waiting clergy. As much as the individual animals themselves, it was the animal-human relationship that was celebrated. The choir sang, and young girls lined the aisles, waving colorful flags. As the animals slowly turned to move back up the aisle, the human congregants sang and moved in harmony with the music. As I watched the ritual, I saw how the joys inherent in sharing the world with animals lighted people's faces and enriched their voices. Throughout the church, people bent forward to whisper a word to the dog by their side, or to resettle into their carriers a cat or a rabbit. People not only came to the ceremony in the thousands, they also brought their own animals along. When the service concluded, people and animals walked, two by two, into the cathedral's garden so that clergy could bless each pet with loving words and touch.
Anthropologist Barbara King, her new book is titled Being with Animals. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. So by beginning with that scene at St. John the Divine, you are talking about the connection, the warmth, the support, the kind of relationship mm-hmm. that all creatures have with human beings.
Yes, Dan, that's really right. I talk about almost transformation. I'd even go so far as to say transcendence. I feel that we become transformed in the presence of other animals because it is so much part of our human nature and our human makeup to feel completed by other animals. And part of what I really wanted to do was trace the prehistory and the history of that connection, which is a natural for an anthropologist to do.
Now, when I walked in this studio with Maxie, mm-hmm. my little dog, you said, oh, I feel more relaxed already. Did you really?
Absolutely. I was very excited to meet you, but I had a little muscle tension as I sit here, and I felt a slight relaxing. As soon as I saw, you know, you walked in with a dog in your arms, you looked very comfortable, and the sight of that dog, or maybe, in fact, it was the bond that was very visible to me because he was relaxed with you, just made me feel better. Now, I have felt that way my whole life, growing up around animals in my home, working in Kenya and working in various places in the United States. There's something for me, and I know for many thousands of other people, that I can't get anywhere else.
And to what do you trace that kind of kinship of feeling, that kind of sense of relaxation that you felt and that you saw me experience?
I do trace it very far back in prehistory. You know, we began as prey for other animals. I believe that our perceptual systems and our cognitive systems were tuned very early on. I'm talking about millions of years ago now, the African savanna and the African forests, because we were relatively vulnerable creatures, our early ancestors. So we were much more eaten rather than the eaters. That's a basic foundation for keen attention to other animals. But what interests me the most is that as our brain developed and our human groups and our kinship with other humans developed, right along with that, we find traces of emotional connection in prehistory. Now, to give you some examples, I think everyone is aware of the cave paintings, both in Western Europe and also in Africa and Australia, in that case, rock paintings. What we see are not only animals painted that might be for the hunt, but we see evidence of what I think is an emotional connection. For example, there are human animal hybrid images. People are thinking about these animals in ways that go far beyond survival.
Barbara King, and the book we're talking about is titled Being with Animals. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk a little more and take your calls. We talk with anthropologist Barbara King about her new book, Being with Animals. Here's a beautiful quote sent to us by Rudd in Oberlin, Ohio. He spotted it on a bronze plaque in the Lusaka, Zambia airport. Here's what it says. Creatures of the wild, we patronize them for their incompleteness, for their tragic fate of having taken form so far below ourselves. And therein we err, and greatly err, for the animal shall not be measured by man. In a world older and more complete than ours, they move finished and complete, gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are not brethren, they are not underlings, they are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth. The quote is attributed to Henry Beston. Just lovely.
That is beautiful. And I'm particularly struck by the phrase, the net of life and time. That really speaks to what I'm talking about as well, very beautifully. We have journeyed with other animals in the net of life and time, to the extent that I would go so far as to say that we've co-created each other, which means that I too want to reject an immediate assumption of human superiority, because I believe that we couldn't be what we are today. Of course, we are animals, but for convenience, we call ourselves humans. We couldn't be what we are today had we not made that journey through life and time with other animals.
How so?
Well, let me go back to prehistory for just a little bit. I was talking about the glorious cave paintings. We could take an example from France of Chauvet Cave at 35,000 years ago. This was a cave inhabited by bears. One can see bear bones and, in fact, impressions in the cave floor of where bears slept. Humans did not only paint bears, however. There is a beautiful painting that is half woman, half human woman, and half buffalo. And this is why I suggest that there is a journey that humans, even back that far, are on with other animals.
And what is the nature of the journey?
Well, we have to make inferences about this. What we can say is that we don't know the particular interpretations people's minds were making. We can't get into the ancient mind. What we can say is that there is a sense of that transformation that we've been talking about emotionally that is embodied on a cave wall by this hybrid figure. Another example, and there are other examples in other caves, but we also find at, say, 10 to 12,000 years ago, that there are burials of people with animals. There's a very, to me, moving example of a man in an ancient Turkish village at right about 9,000 years ago who was buried together with a lamb. And not only that, the two creatures were buried together under the floor of a house where people lived and where human ancestors of that family were also buried. In other words, here is the very earliest root, not only of thinking about human-animal transformation, but about bringing animals into our hearth, into our lives, and even taking them to death with us. So I think that when we today make choices of bringing animals into our homes, of honoring animals as our companions, if we look into prehistory, we see those roots, and I find that very exciting.
So you go so far as to say that Homo sapiens actually became human by being with animals.
I do. I think that this was true at pervasive levels, again, moving beyond food and survival. But the famous and recently deceased anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss often said that animals are good to think with. So in other words, we figured out our place in the world to some extent by comparison and by understanding what does it mean to be who we are, that we share so much with other animals, perceptual systems, cognitive and emotional systems. But it would also be wrong to say that we are identical to other animals. I mean, we needn't think hierarchically, but yet we are unique in our own ways, as animals are in theirs. How are we different from apes, for example? That's a question that's as interesting to me as is how we are similar. And I think that that question at some level has motivated human thinking and human emotional response throughout the millennia.
One other thing that caught my eye, you say humans tame animals or animals choose to become domesticated. You go on to say animals joined us when it helped them to do so. Explain what you mean.
Yeah. You know, typically it's easy for us to fall into a habit of thinking that as, you know, a dominant species on this planet, we were able to tame the horses, we could tame the dogs, and so forth. But the best and most recent anthropological science tells us that animals were making choices. For example, a dog that would come close to a campfire would perhaps be able to get more scraps of meat, would be able to join in on a hunting foray, and would increase its own survivorship for itself and for its offspring, and might also be able to respond emotionally to the humans who were giving it some food and giving it some attention. So in other words, what I write about is the fact that animals are not being coerced. I play a sort of mental trick in the book or tell a thought story and say, think about why are moose not domesticated? Why are young girls ages 11 through 13 not growing up watching moose movies and reading about moose stories as they do about horses? Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, moose did not choose to be domesticated for some reason that we don't fully understand. Horses did. I'm not suggesting that this is some kind of, you know, new age animal controlling the human history, but rather that there was a mutuality, that animals did get something out of it for themselves. And we lose sight of that, I think. And that's the mutuality in the relationship that I'm trying to bring back into our focus.
How might that help us in our own thinking?
I think it's very important to go back to the quote that your listener, Rudd, sent in, and to realize that there are animals animate in their own lives, immersed in their own lives, with concerns that matter to them. In other words, it's so easy for us to fall into the trap of thinking that our world is the important one. And in fact, even to the extent of the cats that I live with, I realize every day that what happens to them on an hour-by-hour basis, their cat dynamics and their cat feelings, I mean, matters as much to them as you and I going through our daily lives. And I think that that mental shift of recognizing the mutuality, the fact that animals are making choices, the fact that we cast ourselves as the lead actors, but we need to remember that we are not always, can help us in how we respond to animals, the care and love that we give them, which I believe is a very important part of our responsibility as Homo sapiens.
Now, of course, there are hundreds of listeners out there, indeed thousands, who want to know whether you are a vegetarian.
I am not a vegetarian, but I am close to a vegetarian. My husband, who is here in Washington with me today, adopted vegetarianism about 5 or 6 years ago. We are concerned about factory farming. We are concerned about animals. I do eat a small bit of meat. I am trying to decrease that year by year. I understand the question. I do eat some chicken. I do eat some fish. I eat no beef, no lamb, no pork. I really don't know that I can justify that. It's a personal choice that I've made. I try to work for animal welfare in other ways, and I try to encourage people to at least have a meatless day a week, cut down on meat. That, I think, is very important, as important perhaps as a full commitment to vegetarianism.
Barbara King is a biological anthropologist. She's professor at the College of William and Mary. Her new book is titled Being with Animals. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's open the phones. We'll go first to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, sir.
To you both. I wonder if either of you are aware of Socrates in conversation with Glaucon in Plato's Republic. And I think the question that they're discussing is, how do you achieve happiness? And the question comes back. It's a Socratic method all about questioning. And Socrates says, well, can a person be happy with an unjust society? Or maybe the question is how to achieve justice. So we can't have a just society if people are unhappy. Socrates asks, can you really be happy if you're eating animals and you have to visit the doctor more often, and if you increase or encourage this desire to eat animals, your pasture land will not be enough. You'll have to go to war with your neighbor. Now maybe we go to war to get oil to have fertilizer and refrigeration to support our animal habit. And he also asked, can you really be happy knowing that two hours before your meal, you could have looked into the eyes of this animal and seen yourself reflected?
All right. And you talk about looking into the eyes of creatures, Barbara.
Yes, I do. I think John brings up an important point. I would say that it is important to recognize the sentient selves that we spend our lives with. that can be anything from an ape in the wild to the cat or dog in your home. There are, I would say, many ways to work towards recognizing that selfhood that animals exhibit, and vegetarianism is one of them. What I'd like to say is that when we do look into the eyes of animal companions, we feel that mutual attunement that we've been talking about. But there's also another kind of attunement that comes with being with animals. And I think back to my experience going to Yellowstone National Park, which is a place that I love, and walking out a little bit in that park, I come across buffalo, which I think are some of the most majestic and wonderful creatures. And I look at them. I do feel an emotional response looking into their eyes. I don't believe that there's mutual attunement. In fact, part of what I find so moving and wonderful is that they seem completely indifferent to my presence. They may be striding across a field, foraging. They may be playing with their calves. But the attunement that I feel is basically with the universe, if you will. For some people, it may be spiritual. For others, it may be secular. But the sight of that animal going about its life and free in the world to do so brings up an attunement in me in a larger sense.
Barbara King, her new book is titled Being with Animals, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Barbara, you've used the word attunement several times. Define that for us.
It's an awareness of the emotional state that the other is in. I write a little bit about Martin Buber. Some people may be aware of his work as a Jewish theologian in the I-thou realm. In other words, to really look someone in the eye and see them as their own self, not as an extension of you, not as an object to be eaten or to be used. And I have been very moved by people who have been telling me their experiences with their animals. For example, I have a friend who has fibromyalgia and suffers with a lot of joint aches and had a particular problem one day with a very achy shoulder, came home and laid down, and her cat came, looked at her, and draped himself directly over the spot that was hurting. There had been no cloth there or no bandage there or nothing. Neither had my friend pointed to it. Perhaps it's a temperature difference. I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily a mental process on the part of the cat, but yet that is an emotional process of attunement. So we can see it on a very immediate level with our animals, and we can also see it in this larger way. Just to make one more point about Yellowstone, when I'm with the buffalo, I feel that I'm thinking a little bit about American history. We know that the buffalo has been so important to American Indians, to our history. And in the same way, I, as an anthropologist, think about the whole sweep of the past when I see animals and realize that we have always been connected with them. Animals kind of trigger for me that sense of that evolutionary journey.
You mentioned your friend with fibromyalgia. Is there any credence to the notion that dogs can spot cancer?
I had the same question, and being a scientist, I wanted to be sure that I knew the answer, so I did read the literature. And yes, the studies that I'm aware of show that first it's necessary to train a dog's odor, between there's the smell of a known cancer versus a sort of healthier smell, if you will. And then you can take the dog to a group of people, and they can smell what later is proven to be an incipient cancer. So in other words, it's a process of acclimatizing them to that smell first, and then they are able to pick out people who later are medically confirmed to have cancer. This is extremely young as a discipline. It's something that we don't know a lot about yet. So I'm cautious about this. I think this is a hint in the medical literature rather than a firm certainty. We need a lot of replication of the scientific work.
What does that make you think about dogs and their ability?
Well, if I may invoke once more the caller Rudd's quote, he quoted this passage about an extension of the senses. I mean, we have to realize two things that this tells us, that not every creature in the world sees and hears as we do. Sometimes these senses surpass ours or go into different realms. And the other is, I mean, we have to realize that we have been with dogs for 15,000 years. When people crossed the Bering Strait into America, I recently learned, they came with dogs. So this is a very long history. It doesn't surprise me that dogs would be able to do this. It tells us something about how it's not just a perceptual question, but the fact that a dog could be that attuned to wanting to be that close to a person, wanting to experience that proximity with a strange person. This tells us that, again, we have mutually created this opportunity through these thousands of years of relating with dogs.
Barbara King, and her new book is titled Being with Animals, Why We're Obsessed with the Furry, Scaly, Feathered Creatures Who Populate Our World. We'll take a short break. We have many calls. We'll get to them after a break.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Jeff Goodell talks about the lobbies that have tried to block climate change legislation.
We're not just talking about a couple of oil or gas companies. We're talking about the whole industrial infrastructure of America.
And journalist Mark Shapiro tells us how cap and trade works in Europe and why the financial industry loves it. Join us.
And we'll go right back to the phones. Your questions for Barbara King on her new book, Being with Animals. To Salt Lake City, Utah. Good morning, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I had a comment and a question. First of all, although it's undeniable there's a connection between human beings and animals, simply because we are animals, I think we've run into a dangerous question of anthropomorphizing them, because animals are not human beings, and we are not like other animals. We're very much different. So although there's similarities, I think that it's dangerous to anthropomorphize them too much. And then my second question, my question was actually going to be, with respect to the animal kingdom, with the rise of modernity, we've often found there's been a greater exploitation of natural resources, and with that, animals. And so I wanted to hear you speak about the rise of modernity, and specifically how it seems like in this day and age we've turned more towards the natural world as if we've realized what we've lost. So,
all right. Thanks for calling.
Well, Sam, I think you bring up a very apt point. Anthropomorphism is something that I think a lot about. And just to be clear what we're talking about, that's the ascribing of human qualities to animals. And I have learned a great deal on this topic from Jane Goodall, the famous chimpanzee researcher. And she has taught me that it is possible to feel a sense of community with other animals, but to also detach at some point and be able to ask the hard questions about how we're different. This is why I mentioned earlier that as an anthropologist, I do want to keep in mind that humans are unique. There's no question about that. So what do we do? When I sit in front of a cage or an enclosure of apes, sometimes I use anthropomorphism to ask questions, to say, for example, well, that female has recently had a baby. Might she be feeling tired? That's anthropomorphic from my memory of having a baby and being tired. But what that does is it only leads to a question. Then what you do is you let the data guide you to the answer. Jane Goodall feels that the anthropomorphism part comes in helping you think of questions that you might never have thought of if you weren't realizing that some animals may reflect some degree of human emotion.
And is that going to change the behavior of the human toward the animal?
Yeah, and I think that that is so key, that this is a very contingent system, by which I mean how you act towards an animal and how you raise an animal is going to change that animal. So I don't want to be overly anthropomorphic. I think it is a human tendency. I think in science you have to watch out for it and give it its precise role. But let me say also that I've spent time with a wonderful bonobo named Kanzi, who now lives in Iowa. He is able to comprehend a great deal of human language, and he's able to also produce utterances using computer symbols. And the reason he's able to do this is because, Diana, of just what you said, how people acted towards him. They immersed him in cultural symbols and cultural rituals from the time of his birth. And as we do with human children, people expected him to enter into conversation with them. And as a result of this immersion, and as the result of having an ape capable brain, he does communicate in very advanced ways, in ways that other apes don't, because they didn't have that upbringing.
Here's an email which is coming in from Andrew in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, who says, I'm very sympathetic to your guest's love of animals. I love my dogs. But I think it's important we not romanticize those relationships. People and animals are ruthless. Both are capable of love. There are flip sides of the same coin. Chimps kill and eat monkeys and will kill chimps. Recent evidence shows that people killed and consumed other humans, Neanderthals. Some animals will eat their own young on occasion. I'm just trying to say that I love you and I eat you are not opposite statements. They are very close. As when a mother says to her small child, I could just eat you up. Most of the mistakes we make with animals come from treating them like humans, like the young man who went to live with grizzlies and they killed him.
Okay, maybe I can say something that speaks both to Andrew's question and Sam's second question. I agree that it's very important not to romanticize animals. And what we've been talking about so far are the positive attunements, the positive empathy. But there is another side of it, and I don't neglect that. Chimpanzees do kill chimpanzees, and to my mind, that makes us more like us than anything else because they are double-sided creatures, as we are. Chimpanzees show compassion for each other. For example, if one is injured, another may bring it food. At the same time, there is a murder rate at Gombe, where Jane Goodall does her work in Tanzania, that can be compared to any city in the world. So it is a complicated thing. I don't consider chimpanzees killing monkeys as aggressive. I consider that as just living. That's what they do. They're partly predatory, as we are partly predatory. But I think the callers are bringing up something that cannot be ignored. And that is, amidst all this positive attunement, we have exploitation of animals. I mean, it's very clear. There's animal cruelty. There's animal abuse. This I understand as the flip side of our emotional connection. Whenever we have deep emotion, there's going to be, sad to say, another side. If you think about love in human families, we know that there's deep love between partners, whether they be marital partners or parents and children. We also know that there's domestic abuse, that there's violence. Deep emotion can be channeled positively, but it can sort of run amok. We see this, and I think what we have to be able to do is care for animals whether we anthropomorphize them or whether they're like us. You know, we don't want to just care for the elephants and the apes and the dolphins and the pandas. But we need to see that our responsibility is to the animals that we might see as highly aggressive, predatory snakes, toxic snakes. I mean, you know, we don't want to ignore them in this conversation. Part of the work that I want to do is to say that collectively we can make a difference and turn towards the natural world differently, not because we anthropomorphize, but because we honor what animals are in their own lives.
Let's take a call from Susan in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Ms. King, I appreciate what you're saying, and I find myself to be kind of on the fence in terms of vegetarianism. And I think about the Mickey Mouse example, and then I think about how people use mouse traps, and we use mice and tests for pharmaceuticals. And I guess I'm not entirely clear what I'm trying to say, except that I find myself being pretty conflicted. And I sort of wonder, it seems like some people are not. And for me, if I look at a fish in a fishbowl, it makes me sad. Maybe that's a little overly sensitive, but then I can't quite understand what the other side of it, where people don't seem to have any sort of misgivings about, big factory farming or that kind of thing. I wondered what your thoughts might be on that.
Susan, I think you've raised some good points. I can remember being up at our farm in Pennsylvania where we had some little brown field mice in the house. And after trying to usher them out the door time and time and time again, finally having to set a kind of mouse trap, and it's very hard to see that tiny, helpless creature in the wrong place. In the wrong place because we have divided the outdoors from the indoors where we humans abide. How do you get over that separation that needs to be?
Yeah, that's a tough question. And to Susan, I would say that I think being conflicted is a good thing. I tell my students at William & Mary, if you're not, you know, confused about some of the hard issues you're thinking about, then, you know, you're not thinking hard enough. So being conflicted is something I relate to. I don't know that I have an easy answer to this. I think a lot about deer, for example, invading suburbia. A member of my family recently told me that where he lives in New Jersey, there's culling of deer where people are going out with bows and arrows, and the town was divided between people who were protesting on behalf of the deer that they shouldn't suffer and other people saying that if we don't cull the herds, the animals will simply die of starvation, or the example that you raised of rodents in our home. My answer is only that whatever we do, we need to make sure that we minimize suffering. If we need to carry out actions of removing an animal from some environment, if that is the decision that is made and that has to happen, I think the only thing to do is just to make sure the animals don't suffer. Now, clearly, when we're talking about things like biomedical research, I'm hoping that we move away from animal models and find alternatives altogether. But, you know, realistically, we are going to have these clashes, and we're going to make choices that are difficult. And in that case, we have to think of animal suffering.
All right. Let's go now to El Dorado, Kansas. Good morning, Michael.
Hello. Fascinating topic. I read an article by an anthropologist in which he said that one of the most distinctive differences he'd found between Neanderthal sites and human sites was that human sites often had domesticated dogs, which, if I understand the history correctly, that would have been well more than 15,000 mm-hmm. years ago. That would be quite a long history of us together. Are you familiar with this?
My reading of the science literature is that the good evidence we have for domesticated dogs is from 15,000 years ago. I'm not aware of anything before then. We may have interaction, of course, of wild dogs in early humans. There are some very fascinating differences with Neanderthals and Homo sapiens that are relevant here. Neanderthals are our first cousins who bury the dead and often include animal bones. But only when we get to Homo sapiens do burials actually include animals themselves. And I found examples from around the world. For example, Cyprus, at 9,000 years ago, a woman buried with a cat. We can think of the great Egyptian culture of lots and lots of examples of tombs and burials with animals. So that is fairly new. So I don't believe that the dog-human bond is older than that, unless it's material that I'm unaware of.
Michael, thanks for your call and your listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to Salem, Ohio. Good morning, Dawn.
Good morning. I'd like to know what she thinks of the bond between human and birds. I have several cockatoos at home, and I find that bond to be just absolutely amazing.
Yes, I have a friend who lives around the corner from me who has rehabilitated crippled crows. And the bond between my friend and the crow was an amazing thing to see. I do write a little bit about that.
Dawn, can you describe your relationship with your cockatoo?
Well, I have one in particular that I rescued, and we are just amazingly connected. He had cancer on his wing, and they removed his wing. The doctor called me after the surgery and said, you know, he's not going to make it. He's dying. Mm. I asked to come up, and the doctor said he didn't think it would be a good thing, but I went up and I went in, and he was nearly dead, and I just started talking to him, and it was amazing. Within the hour, I took him home.
Oh. Oh, what a great story. So there's the power of attunement for you. You know, I actually live with quite a number of cats, and my husband and I rescue homeless cats, and we spay neuter feral cats to reduce the population. And so we've had quite a number of close encounters with injured and traumatized cats. So I relate to what you're saying, because I think sometimes the only thing, I mean, it doesn't always work, but something that can give an animal a lot of hope and a lot of motivation is that feeling of care, one-to-one.
Isn't that interesting?
I believe that.
And Dawn, is your cockatoo still living?
Yes, he is. Yes, he's doing quite fine.
Glad to hear that. Okay.
I'm hoping he'll be with me a long time.
I hope so, too. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And to George in Hunt, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to comment. I've got a herd of elk that visits me every hunting season to hide out and seek sanctuary. I just finished feeding them a little while ago. There's 16 of them. And I've noticed that their behavior seems to be a lot more tribal than herd-like. Everybody talks about herds of elk, but one time the herd bull decided to take the herd, and he left for about 3 or 4 weeks, but he left behind the 3 fawns with 1 adult female to act as a nanny and also 1 of the young bulls to act as a guard. So I was wondering, what's your comment on that?
Well, my first comment is that I'm jealous. I'd love to be able to see elk. You know, I am a little bit uncertain about how to interpret that behavior. I don't know a great deal about elk behavior. So I would just say that if, in fact, you're suggesting that there is actual leadership on the part of the male, I believe.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that.
That you're suggesting that there's leadership qualities on the part of the male in taking care of his group?
Yeah, there's the herd bull definitely is the organizer of the whole herd, and he's very tender and attentive towards the rest of them. But like I say, when they do decide to take off, they always leave, you know, if they leave the fawns behind, they always leave one female and one male to take care of them.
Nice observation.
I should say. George, thanks for calling. And again, Barbara King is clearly envious of your situation. Barbara, fascinating book, and really gives us lots to think about. I know you'll continue with your work. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Diane. I had great fun being here.
Barbara King, she's a biological anthropologist and professor at the College of William and Mary. Her new book is titled Being with Animals, Why We Are Obsessed with the Furry, Scaly, Feathered Creatures Who Populate Our World. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.